Alaska has a problem. When Prudhoe Bay was discovered almost 50 years ago, it had a lot of oil. And now it has a lot less. And that's creating some challenges for the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
Let me get this. Wait for it.
The best way to understand this is there's this video. It's a surveillance video from a station along the pipeline, and a couple engineers showed it to us.
Oh my God. Wait, what are we looking at here?
What we are looking at is footage of a giant hunk of thick black wax. It's been pushed out of a section of the pipeline like toothpaste squeezed from a tube. And it is huge, 20 feet long, 5 feet tall. Guys in protective suits and respirator masks are hacking away at it with picks and shovels. And they are not making much progress.
This is technically called a wax event. But pipeline engineer Tom Marchesani has a different name for it.
The big Tootsie Roll, we like to call it.
It's an extreme example of what can happen as less oil moves down the Trans-Alaska pipeline. With less oil, it moves more slowly and starts to cool. As it cools, wax in the oil solidifies and drops out, gunking up the pipe and sometimes forming the world's biggest, most unappetizing Tootsie Rolls. And that's just one of the many things that start to go wrong when there's not enough oil in the pipeline. It's the kind of problem that has some Alaskans worried about the end of the pipeline and the end of Alaska as we know it. Alaska is an oil state, but it wasn't always, and it almost wasn't. Hello and welcome to Midnight Oil. I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh.
And I'm Rachel Waldholz. This is the story of how Alaska became an oil state that asks if we'll always be an oil state. And this is our last episode. We've talked about the discovery of oil on the North Slope and the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
We've talked about Alaska's big bust, the Great Recession of the 1980s.
And we've talked about the creation of a couple totally unique institutions, Alaska Native Corporations and the Permanent Fund.
In this episode, we put all the pieces together. Today, the state is reeling from a 1-2 punch of low oil prices and declining oil production. So, after a 40-year roller coaster ride with one of the most powerful and unpredictable industries in the world, we ask, what's next for Alaska?
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. AYOGA is celebrating 40 years of Alaska's grit and determination that made Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline possible. Find more history at ourakspirit.com. With additional support from NPR Story Lab.
Today, the pipeline is carrying a quarter of what it did in its heyday, a little over 500,000 barrels per day. The reason? Prudhoe Bay and the other legacy fields on Alaska's North Slope are getting older, and they aren't producing oil the way they used to. That's an economic problem for the state, but it's also an engineering problem. And there's a name for it, low flow. Rob Annett is an engineer with Alyeska, the company that operates the pipeline. He says as the amount of oil in the pipeline drops, it starts to raise some existential questions.
Is there some sort of, potentially, a tipping point where the way you've always done it doesn't work anymore?
Alyeska thinks there is a tipping point, a magic number. A 2011 study put it somewhere around 300,000 barrels a day. Below that point, they're not sure how the pipeline will work, or if it will work. State and federal forecasts predict that we'll approach that threshold in the next decade. In oil industry years, that is very, very soon.
So a couple of years ago, the company called in Rob Annett, and they told him to form a team. Their task? Figure out how to keep the pipeline going. Annett picked out four other engineers. Think of him as kind of like George Clooney in the movie Ocean's 11.
You're going to need a crew as nuts as you are. Who do you got in mind?
Except, you know, oil engineers. They don't seem to mind the Ocean's 11 comparison.
Okay, who's who? Obviously you're Clooney, right?
Okay. For the past few years, Anna and his crew have considered all kinds of crazy ideas. Even the craziest idea of all.
You've considered just building a whole new pipeline. Yeah,
absolutely. That's
right-sizing it.
Yeah. So you know, mother, may I have, you know, a gajillion dollars to do that, right? So, you know, as you might imagine, that one didn't really land well. So
yeah, a whole new pipeline, a smaller one, that would solve the problem. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline is 4 feet wide, built for the state's boom times. A smaller line would let today's lower volumes run faster and stay warmer.
But obviously, that doesn't really pencil out. So they're exploring other ideas, like super high-tech pipe scrapers that might remove wax more efficiently, or maybe injecting some kind of antifreeze. Other ideas they couldn't even tell us about. Maybe top-secret ideas that are so crazy they might just work. But the team hasn't found its silver bullet yet, and the clock is ticking. I ask Mark Azzani how he feels about that.
I'd be so stressed out if I was you.
Well, Rob lets us play reggae music in, and that tends to calm us all down.
All joking aside, though, Annett says the pressure is real.
I think the end game is not going to be strictly technical. I think it's going to be, you know, an economic viability for the people who own the pipeline.
The people who own the pipeline. That would be the top three oil companies in Alaska. BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil. In the end, the pipeline's future won't be in the hands of engineers. All the solutions Annett's team dreams up come at a price. Someday, somebody in an office building somewhere will run the numbers and decide there's just not enough oil flowing to justify the cost to keep the pipeline running.
And that is not our only problem.
Something extraordinary has been happening to the oil price. It's been tumbling to levels no one thought we'd see.
In 2014, oil prices dropped off a cliff. Over the next year and a half, they slid from more than $100 a barrel to $50 to $30. These days, the price is hovering around $50 a barrel. And oil companies are buckling in for what they call lower for longer. And this is a big deal for Alaska.
This was foreseeable. This day was foreseeable.
That's Alaska Governor Bill Walker in 2015, about a year and a half into the oil slump. He was making the case that the state has to start planning for the future. He had his grandson by his side as a symbol of future generations.
We have tied almost 90% of our revenue to a non-renewable resource that has been in decline.
It's hard to overstate how much Alaska relies on oil. Directly or indirectly, oil pays for everything. Our roads, our schools, this radio station. Alaskans don't pay a state sales or income tax, so oil funds the government. The drop in prices punched a massive hole in the state budget. And the slump has tipped Alaska into its first real recession in 3 decades.
This is forcing Alaska to confront a question we've been ducking for 40 years. What do we do when the oil runs out? What if the world doesn't need our oil any longer? What does a post-oil Alaska look like? Honestly, I couldn't even imagine. So I called up a few longtime Alaskans to help me play this one out.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Larry. How's it going? My first call was to Larry Persley, a former Alaska reporter who's been a close observer of the oil and gas industry. Persley wasn't exactly optimistic.
If North Slope oil production ever shut down and the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline ever shut down and the flow of money to the treasury and communities ever shut down, it would be horrendous.
Personally, ticked off other places that lost their economic lifelines. Gary, Indiana. Youngstown, Ohio. Detroit, Michigan. Do these cities foreshadow Alaska's future? Maybe not exactly, Personally says. Alaska leans on oil to an extreme degree, but it has other industries like fishing, healthcare, and tourism. But still, personally thinks that as production declines, Alaska will shrink.
Not geographically, but in terms of jobs and population and the size of the economy, I just don't see a way out of it.
State economist Neil Fried was also pretty gloomy when I called to ask him what Alaska would be like with no oil.
It's very hard to see positives coming out of that kind of scenario.
Fried says the oil industry's loss would ripple across the state's entire economy. As oil industry wages fall, wages in other industries could fall too. And Alaskans with smaller paychecks spend less in restaurants, buy fewer cars, spend less on mortgages.
It would certainly have a big influence on our broad standard of living.
Fried says even if we start paying state taxes, no more oil revenue would make it much harder for the state to provide all the services we've enjoyed for the last 40 years. But Fried's been in Alaska for a long time, and he thinks something will turn up to save us.
And, you know, what's most likely is something happens that none of us even thought about. That's the most likely scenario.
And you have no idea what that is.
That's correct.
That's correct, he says, because that's what happened before. It's what happened way back in the 60s, when the state was broke, and an unassuming geologist named Tom Marshall thought there might be oil beneath a remote chunk of the Arctic called Prudhoe Bay. We talked about Marshall back in episode 1. People thought he was nuts. They called his idea Marshall's Folly. But he was right, and there are a lot of people in Alaska who think we may be in for a repeat. When you talk to people in the oil industry, and to plenty of Alaska's elected officials, the answer to low flow is find more oil. And they could be right. In the last year, there have been not one, not two, but three potentially major oil discoveries in Alaska. It would be a big deal if they all pan out. One small company, Kalis Energy, thinks it's found 6 billion barrels of oil. It would be the biggest discovery in Alaska since the 1960s.
Kalis's CEO is Jim Musselman. He's a true believer.
Okay, well, bring the map and I'll just we can talk off of that.
I talked to Musselman last fall, right after his company announced their big discovery. Musselman is the epitome of a big Texas oil man, and he has big dreams for Alaska.
We envision there's going to be thousands of new jobs created up here. You know, it's going to be huge, huge, huge.
The company hasn't yet confirmed all that oil is really there. But if it is, well, that would take care of the low flow problem. From Musselman's perspective, Alaska's oil fields are a long way from running dry.
There's just lots of oil yet to be discovered here. And that's what I want to make sure and reiterate to the people of Alaska. Don't give up here. There's a lot to be found. And if you'll just work with us, we'll find a lot more oil for you yet.
And lots of people in Alaska's oil industry agree. But developing a new oil field in the Arctic is risky and expensive. Kalis has already postponed its next steps, citing low prices and changes to the state's oil taxes. And the discovery has environmental groups on high alert. So Alaskans can't ignore the possibility of new oil discoveries, but we can't count on them either. And oh yeah, Rachel, there's also that whole other thing we have to worry about.
Climate change. When it comes to global warming, Alaska's in an awkward position.
Larry Persily, I called him earlier to talk about Alaska's doomsday scenario. He put it best.
Can you send 737,000 people to therapy all at one time? Because we are conflicted.
The state's in trouble if we don't get more oil out of the ground, but it's also in trouble if we do.
We're going to suffer the effects of climate change as much or more than most other Americans, but we're also very dependent on, extremely dependent on fossil fuels.
Alaska's on the front lines of climate change. Permafrost is thawing. Sea ice is shrinking. Whole villages are trying to move away from the coast. We've become a kind of global poster child for climate change.
But in Alaska, you don't often hear people talking about the elephant in the room, that dealing with climate change means, eventually, burning less fossil fuels. No matter what happens when it comes to climate change, some people are betting on a different kind of future for Alaska. And you can find a lot of them here, at the boardroom. It's a co-working space. That's millennial tech speak for a shared office. It takes up two floors of an office building in downtown Anchorage. It's a bright space with big windows and stylish 20 and 30-somethings hunched over their laptops. Here, you can find people like Laura Wilcox.
We are a brand new startup company.
Her company is developing microgrids, standalone electric grids, for rural Alaska. Wilcox left the oil and gas industry a year ago after too many pay cuts and layoffs.
But I see this as the natural progression that our economy is in right now in terms of energy and what drives power production in our country.
Wilcox and her peers are part of a new startup culture in Alaska, with more interest and support than ever before. Every week, the boardroom hosts a pitch session for local entrepreneurs. Today, it's a company that sells hydroponic growing systems for growing vegetables inside.
Thank you. So I want to start by telling you a little bit of a story of why I got in here.
But microgrids and hydroponics are not the next BP and Exxon. So how do you get from here to a real economy?
I mean, individually, no. None of these industries is going to replace oil. It can't. But in aggregate, this is how you transform an economy.
John Bittner heads up the Alaska Small Business Development Center. So it's basically his job to be optimistic about the future. He's kind of a walking TED Talk. And I mean that in the best possible way.
We asked him to pitch his best case scenario. He says, first of all, we're not walking into the future with nothing. He says previous generations put institutions in place during the early days of oil, and now they've matured. That includes the Permanent Fund, our giant savings account. We talked about it in episode 5. Before oil ever flowed down the pipeline, Alaska lawmakers decided to stash some of that money away. These days, the Permanent Fund is at more than $60 billion. It earns more from its investments each year than the state takes in from oil and gas. Some of that money goes to pay for dividends to everyone in the state. But in the future, it could also help pay for state government.
Another piece of the puzzle? Alaska Native corporations. We told the story of how they were created in episode 2. Bittner says they play a big role in their regions, and they're tied to the land. They aren't going anywhere, no matter what happens in the economy. He says we should see the oil years as a gift.
So we got a jump start. We got a jump start that nobody predicted. And now it's up to us to run with it.
He imagines an economy built on exactly the things that make Alaska a tough place to do business. Distance, high energy costs, high transportation costs, high healthcare costs. Those are problems all over the world. And Bittner says technologies like Wilcox's microgrids can be developed in Alaska and then exported.
Right. The problems we solve here, we're not solving for the continental U.S. We're solving for Asia. We're solving for Africa. We're solving for India. And those are huge emerging markets.
He says, ultimately, Alaskans have to decide how to look at this moment.
We have to decide what the narrative is, right? Are we all sort of watching Rome burn, or are we on the cusp of some sort of amazing transformation?
Alaska is an oil state, but it wasn't always, and it almost wasn't. And someday, it might not be an oil state anymore. Thanks for listening to Midnight Oil from Alaska's Energy Desk. Our story was edited by Annie Feit and Jennifer Pemberton and mixed by Dave Waldron.
James Glaves composed our theme music. We had help from Allison McAdam, Emily Kwong, and Zachariah Hughes.
In addition to the voices in the story, thanks to everyone who helped us understand these issues, including Cliff Groh, Catherine Jernstrom, Isaac Vanderberg, Penny Gage, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, and Cody Rice and Allison Walters at Wood Mackenzie.
Our media producer extraordinaire is Eric Keddo. He's interviewing some of the folks who live and work along the pipeline today. Check out his video profiles at alaskapublic.org. And thanks to you for listening to the show, especially those of you who've sent feedback. This is our last episode, but you can catch up on past episodes wherever you get your podcasts. If you like it, rate us on iTunes or tap Interesting on NPR One to help more people find the show.
And you can find more stories about energy and environment in the last frontier from Alaska's Energy Desk at alaskapublic.org. I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh.
And I'm Rachel Waldholtz. This is Midnight Oil.